So again, wonderful to see you all today, to be back with my friends in Lama Yeshe Ling. I wish I was there in person, but looks like that won't be happening for a little while yet. But anyway, it's great to be able to share this text with all of you. Thank you for the invitation to do that. So this text, again, as I mentioned in the introductory meditation, is one of the most beloved texts in what is known as the Lojong or the mind training tradition, which I'll talk about shortly. I do want to mention that I've received teachings on this from Kensur Jumpa Tekchuk in Italy. Had a wonderful weekend of teachings with him on this. The initial teachings I had, though, were from Kyabje Rigpa Rinpoche, who another one of my gurus. So anyway, I feel very honored that I can share these teachings with all of you. Now, by no means should you expect that because I've received teachings on these that I've actualized these teachings. I'm doing my best to practice them as well as I can. One of the things about these teachings that I'll say is a caution when we go into them as well is that this is a rather extensive text in terms of having a lot of pieces of advice. Most of you are familiar with this text from probably having read a book here or there because there are a lot of published commentaries. It's 7 points of mind training, but each of these points, the first one only has one little slogan within it, but most of them have several slogans. I think in the end, there's over 50 of these individual slogans, pieces of advice, and some of them within them have even other pieces of advice that they are talking to. So there's a lot to this text. So don't expect that as you go through these sessions with me that you'll be able to immediately apply all of these in your life. So I would just set a goal to try to gain, you know, some appreciation for this text, to want to revisit it, to want to study it further, to try to incorporate some of these slogans into your life. You can actually practice them. And I think there was even a little deck of cards that Shambhala published that was Chogyam Trungpa's version of this text that essentially you would take a card each day and practice that slogan. But nonetheless, again, it's something to expect to take on over time. To actually go through this course and be able to practice all of these immediately would be very, very difficult. So to get things started, what I would like to do is to share. I put a little bit of a slideshow together for today. I probably won't do too many slides, though I'll put the text on the slides. Most of you hopefully have downloaded the text. But for today, I wanted to start with some quotes from a relatively new book. This is part of this series that it's called The Library of Wisdom and Compassion, I think, is what I think the title they've given it, published through Wisdom Publications. This is the fifth volume, I think, in that series, In Praise of Great Compassion, that the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron are putting together, really extensive teachings from His Holiness on the Lam Rim. So he says in that book, the mind training practices challenge us to reorient the framework through which we view the world, releasing the self-centered attitude and focusing instead on cherishing others more than self and dedicating our lives to benefiting others temporally in samsara and ultimately by showing them the way to full awakening. So we obviously get right from the beginning, this is all grounded in the Mahayana tradition and the wish to abandon the habitual patterns we've had of being focused on ourselves and to learn to cherish others and to, again, that second part of bodhicitta that we just meditated on, to show them the full way to awakening through our own attainment of that state. They continue, they say, the practice of mind training helps us to remain balanced when we experience either happiness or suffering, without becoming giddy and overly optimistic when we are happy, or discouraged and depressed when we face suffering. Whatever we encounter in life, wealth or poverty, success or failure, a multitude of friends or loneliness, we are steadfast in our pursuit of full awakening. So let me take it off screen for just a moment. This is actually one teaching that in a very early commentary that I purchased, I have it here on my desk, Awakening the Mind, Lightening the Heart. This is by the Dalai Lama. It was part of another little series of just 3 books of teachings by the Dalai Lama. I think this was edited by Donald Lopez. But in here, he talks about how essentially we have 2 different times in our spiritual practice that can be problematic for us. And the first time, of course, is when things go wrong, you know, when we have a lot of difficulties, as all of us in the world have been experiencing over this last year and a half, when things are challenging, when we don't have the ideal situations in terms of wanting things to go our way, wanting to have the freedoms, whatever that we normally experience. When we have problems and difficulties, this is obviously challenging. And sometimes people forget their practice in the midst of that. They think instead, well, and I even was doing some teachings at the beginning of the pandemic, and I was encouraging people, you know, just because all this is going on, this isn't an excuse to not do your practice or whatever. This is like the perfect time to do your practice. So that's one time that actually we're going to be looking at in a lot of detail in terms of how do we work with difficult situations so that we don't let them become an obstacle for us in terms of our practice. This is a big part of the Lojong teachings. But His Holiness also says the other time that we can have, you know, problems and with our spiritual practice not really living up to our ideals is when things are going well. You know, oftentimes when everything's going well, we think, oh, I don't need to practice Dharma. You know, samsara is a, you know, just fine. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing and enjoying life because it's all going so well. Or we get an inflated mind and think, oh, because I'm practicing Dharma so well, my life is turning out so well. Well, these are kind of mistaken ideas that we shouldn't cling to, you know, so tightly. So this is also not something that we're going to see as much in the Lojong teachings, but it's something to keep in mind. As His Holiness says, if we are like a yo-yo and we go up and down constantly, we get really elated when things are going well, we get really depressed when things aren't going well. Well, this isn't mind training at all. You know, this isn't working with kind of finding that sort of balanced level between those two, where we can maintain our dedication to the practice. We can maintain what we're trying to accomplish, keep our eyes on the larger goal and not get caught up in what's happening in the moment. So the Lojong teachings have a lot to offer us in terms of that whole idea that His Holiness is putting forward in that what's on the screen there in front of me. I actually shared that one little bit there on my Facebook page when I was putting out some information for folks to come to this series of classes. So what we're going to do today, this is the agenda for today, is I want to introduce Lojong, which again, most of you have heard of, but I want to go into a little more detail of what this is all about and what is the meaning behind this. Talk a little bit about the origins of these teachings, because you know, I think it is important that we have some grounding in where these teachings came from, an overview of the 7 points, especially as presented by Pabankar Rinpoche. The translation that I provided to all of you is the one that was used in a book called The Kindness of Others that the Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive published, which contained commentary by Khenser Jampa Tekchok. So that is the one that I'm going to be using. It's also the one that you will find on Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive's website, lamayeshe.com. So I put it into a little booklet for you to be able to access this, but I want to give an overview of how they are presented within there and about how we're going to be teaching this in terms of, how I'm going to be teaching this in terms of the order of the individual points. Then I'm going to begin the commentary on the text. Hopefully we'll be able to get into that. So this is the Tibetan script. This is actually from one of those cards from that deck I mentioned from Chogyam Trungpa's collection of these that you could kind of use a card a day. This is the Tibetan script of Lojong. I don't know, don't need to go into the Tibetan, but essentially the first kind of part of it where you see just to the left of that first dot is Lo, it's pronounced Lo. And then the last part is Jong. There are different connotations to these words. So I'd like to share those in terms of the understanding of the Tibetan. Lo is usually translated as mind, but it includes all these concepts, awareness, consciousness, even thoughts and attitudes. While mind is sometimes bigger than our thoughts and our attitudes, in this context, we are talking about transforming and changing our thoughts. The way that we are approaching things. So it is interesting, even I think Lama Zopa Rinpoche often prefers thought transformation as a translation of mind training that we are again using, we'll use more frequently, perhaps mind training, but it's transforming, changing our thoughts. Now this word Jong, there are several interrelated but distinct meanings, Thupten Jinpa says in his introduction to his briefer collection of mind training texts. Again, all of these have some element of transformation involved in them. The first one is, of course, what we normally translate this as is training, mind training. So when you train for something, you acquire a skill or you master a field of knowledge. So training makes a lot of sense in this context because we are training in how to move in the direction of enlightenment through practicing, cherishing others, abandoning our self-centeredness, what have you, all the various things that are entailed in these teachings. Habituation is also a connotation that we have to this word jhong, though. And this has to do with familiarizing with these ways of being and thinking. That's why, once more, I was emphasizing earlier that we can't expect that we're going to become completely habituated and familiarized with these teachings just on the basis of one course. It's something that takes continual study, reflection, working with them day in and day out. But if you can, you know, again, glean a few things from this that you can begin to become more familiar with, well, then that's how you'll start to live your life. You know, the whole thing about the path to enlightenment is that it's one of familiarizing ourselves with different ways of being, different ways of thinking. You know, this is why even the Tibetan word for meditation, gom, is rooted in a word that means to become familiar. You know, oftentimes we think of meditation as simply referring to this practice of sitting on a cushion and watching your breath or whatever, but it's really about what we are doing every moment of our day. Meditation is something we should bring off the cushion into how we are going about talking to others, doing our work, being in whatever situation. We try to bring the Dharma into play whenever we're involved in anything. This is how we actually become familiar with the Dharma, how we start to live, breathe, eat, sleep the Dharma. And that's where change really comes about. So the third idea behind jhong is cultivating or cultivation. Here, cultivating specific mental qualities, such as universal compassion. Sometimes we call it great compassion, or the awakening mind, bodhicitta. These mental qualities we need to cultivate on the path to enlightenment. And Lojong gives us the instruction on how to do that, some specific instructions that we'll go into either later today or in the next class on Tuesday. The final one is kind of an interesting one. It also means cleansing or purifying. I actually found it interesting. There was a book about Tibetan literary genres, and they called it in there thought purification or something like that. And I'd never seen Lojong referred to in that way, but it is because of this connotation of the word jhong, to be about cleansing, purifying, in this case, purifying one's own mind of craving, hatred, and delusion, which are often known as, again, the three poisons. These are the roots of all of our suffering, and they're the roots of suffering for all sentient beings. So we can see that this is also an aspect that we want to be attentive to, is that, and these are all interrelated, all four of these meanings of jhong, because when we purify and try to remove those negative tendencies, of course, in their place will be the positive ones, because that's how we actually get rid of them in their most effective way, is by countering them with the thoughts that are antithetical to them. So we've talked about this. I think even I did the last class, it was two classes ago, because I think the last time I taught for all of you, it was on the eight pillars of joy. And the previous time, I think, was on this whole thing I put together, a course about working to let go of our habitual states of mind, the delusions and what have you. So this is also an aspect of Lojong, is that we want to be able to purify those negative tendencies, to stop being motivated by them, because they're problematic for ourselves, but they also become problematic for others when we have the mind of attachment, hatred, even, you know, again, the root of ignorance. These all are challenging. So this is an idea, again, of what Lojong is all about. Now, when we talk about translating it as mind training or thought transformation, all of the Buddhist teachings are mind training. Everything that we learn from the moment we start our Buddhist practice is about training our minds, changing our minds. So what makes this so unique is the fact that these are actually what we would call mind training within a Mahayana motivation, within the idea that we want to particularly accentuate those teachings that are a part of developing bodhicitta, progressing on the path to enlightenment, as opposed to the more common teachings that the Buddha gave that are about familiarizing ourselves with what will cause our own liberation from suffering. So again, we're going to talk about this a little bit as we go through the text, but essentially everything is rooted in this context, in the Mahayana motivation of bodhicitta, in our desire to use everything we have in our lives to help us to awaken fully, to begin the process of moving towards that goal, as well as to accomplish that goal. So these teachings are, again, a particular genre that came out of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition to some degree, but they have their roots in Indian Buddhism, obviously, and of course in the Buddhist sutras themselves. So without a doubt, this is not something that is newly fabricated. This is not something that, you know, comes from just the minds of these great yogis up in the Himalayas or something. So in terms of where these teachings come from, the origins of them, before I go to the slides and go to the more specific things that are involved in the lineage of these teachings, in particular, the texts that we're going to be studying, I want to talk a little bit about the Buddha's teachings, because if we take all of what the Buddha taught, essentially he taught two aspects of the path that pertain, again, to the two sort of grounds of all of phenomena, in terms of there are the vast world of diversities, of conventional things, everything that exists around us that sentient beings are quite involved in their everyday life. In terms of that, the Buddha taught a path of kind of focusing on method, the vast teachings of the that side of the path, which he disseminated to Maitreya Buddha. And Maitreya Buddha became the sort of lineage holder of all of that. And all of that sort of method side of the path was what the Buddha taught in terms of giving us everything that informs our movement on the path. Because we have to stay involved in the conventional world, even when we start talking about bodhicitta and compassion and what have you. Those are all method aspects. They are all how do we work with our relationship to others and our being able to use everything that we have, again, as an opportunity to move in the direction of enlightenment. That's one corpus of what the Buddha taught. The Buddha, of course, also taught the profound. These are the teachings on ultimate truth, on the final nature of things. And this, of course, is an essential part of our wisdom aspect of the path, where we need to generate the deepest wisdom so that we can actually accomplish what the method path is moving us in the direction of. We often talk about these as being like the wings of the two wings of a bird, the wing of compassion over here and the wing of wisdom. Without both of these wings, the bird can't get to its destination. Without both of these aspects of the path, we can't get to enlightenment. So both of these were taught by the Buddha. This whole body of teachings, again, Maitreya Buddha became the lineage holder of, and Manjushri became the lineage holder of the wisdom teachings. So that's the original source of everything we're going to be talking about, because actually, Lojong teachings contain both elements. We're going to be mostly focusing on conventional bodhicitta and all using conventional truth and our relationship to things and others as a means of moving in the direction of full enlightenment. But there's also a component of it that works with emptiness. And that's because, as we're going to talk about later, we need both of those aspects to combat the deeper errors that we're making. I'll introduce you to them right now. They're usually called the twin demons, and they are involved in almost every Lojong teaching. Any Lojong text is going to, first of all, give us primarily how do we overcome our self-centeredness, our self-cherishing, our tendency to be focused on me, myself, and I to the exclusion of others. This is all the teachings that inform the method side of the path that get us to get out of our little bubble of self-concern and begin to think about others, embrace others, cherish others to the greatest degree. Over here, the demon that we have to combat here is what we call our self-grasping. And again, we can grasp at anything as inherently existent, self-existent, but the main thing is grasping at this I, this capital I, that we, you know, cling to so dearly and that we think is so real, that isn't real in the way that we think it is at all. So the wisdom aspect of the path is needed to overcome, according to these Lojong teachings, the self-grasping, while the method side of the path is needed to overcome our self-cherishing, our self-centeredness. Without both aspects of it, we can't achieve enlightenment, just like, again, the bird can't fly to its destination without both wings. So these teachings are to, in a Mahayana context, put together the essence of what we need on the method side, together with the wisdom side, so that we can have everything, all the tools at our disposal, to be able to move to accomplishing that full goal. So they're very powerful teachings. Again, almost every text has those, both of those elements involved in it. So these teachings, again, start from the Buddha without a doubt. The Buddha didn't sit down and say, okay, now I'm going to teach all the Lojong teachings. They were essentially embedded within many of the Sanskrit sutras. In fact, in this wonderful collection, I mentioned the shorter collection of mind training. Some of you may have this book, actually, to take the little weird cover off that doesn't allow you to see it, but Mind Training by Thupten Jinpa, I don't know. It's a wonderful collection. I haven't read it all. It's a huge book. I don't know how many pages over, 700 pages, I think it looks like. Anyway, when he talks about it in here, he essentially says that, again, we can trace all of these back to a number of the sutras of the Buddha. I'm not going to give you all the names of them, but it's not that these teachings, again, were newly derived in either India by other great masters that came after the Buddha, or even in Tibet. But rather, they were an extension of the main ideas that the Buddha spoke to in the Mahayana sutras. So the Buddha, some 2,600 years ago, teaches these teachings. From there, of course, again, Manjushri played a key role in terms of the development of the wisdom side of the path, which goes through Nagarjuna, which goes to Shantideva, who many of you are quite familiar with. And essentially, that lineage was eventually brought into Lama Atisha, who we're going to talk about shortly. From the side of the method, all of this compassion-oriented teachings, this was again given to Buddha Maitreya, who then gave these teachings to his disciple Asanga. Asanga then became one of the main proponents of the teachings on compassion that come from that lineage that were then also eventually brought into Lama Atisha. Lama Atisha is an amazing being because most of you know his background if you've read any of the Lamrim texts, because he is the person who originally put this structure around the Buddhist teachings that we know of today as the Lamrim. But he became the lineage holder of both of these aspects of the path, the vast and the profound. And of course, he didn't do this so easily at that time. Again, even though these teachings were obviously present, it took great effort in order to receive all of these teachings. So let me introduce you to these folks, and we can get a little bit more into how this text that we have in front of us actually came to be. So Lama Atisha himself, Sri Jnana, I don't know, I put an S there instead of an A in that name. Atisha Dipamkara Sri Jnana lived from 982 to 1054, just about 1,000 years ago. He lived in India, was studying at the monasteries there, and essentially decided on the basis of a request made by the king of Tibet at the time to go to Tibet in 1042 to revitalize the Dharma. But prior to that, of course, he had received this full lineage of teachings by going to Sumatra. Of course, I can't imagine what the journey must have been like for somebody to go from the middle of India to Sumatra at that time. But he made the long journey, and he actually spent a fair amount of time with one of his main gurus, Sirlingpa. Sirlingpa, also known as Dharmakirti of Sumatra, was essentially one of the lineage holders of all the teachings that we are going to be studying. Lama Atisha made this great effort because he knew that these teachings were vital in order to bring the Dharma, the Mahayana Dharma, have it continue to be spread in this world and what have you. He didn't know, of course, at the time that he was going to be going off to Tibet. In fact, the request to come to Tibet, they say actually that he consulted with his guru, one of his gurus in India, and they said, well, if you do go, you're going to lose 20 years of your life. But he said, it'll be a great benefit to many beings if you go. And of course, we're still benefiting because Lama Atisha sacrificed 20 years of his life to go to Tibet and to bring these teachings. But essentially, Lama Atisha made great efforts. He had three main gurus. I think he had over 200 other gurus, but the three root gurus definitely gave him the raw material from which to bring these teachings to Tibet, and to bring them in their entirety. And of course, this is why he's renowned for having brought not just the Lojong teachings, but the Lamrim teachings, the stages of the path teachings, which take all of what the Buddha taught and put it into a very formal structure for how an individual practitioner needs to go through their own spiritual development. So we're going to talk about Lamrim shortly, because again, that is the very first of these slogans, is training in all these preliminaries of the Lamrim. So Lama Atisha, again, amazing being. It's hard for us to, fathom what these beings were all about in terms of their bodhicitta, their compassion, what it took for them to do all of these long journeys to obtain these teachings. He established in the end what has come to be known as the Kadam tradition. This word Kadam in Tibetan, ka literally means words or practical instructions. I'm sorry, words. And then Dham, I'm sorry, means practical instructions. So what this is saying is essentially that this tradition holds on to all the words of the Buddha to be taken as practical instructions. That's what Kadam means, or Kadampa. We often hear that a Kadampa practitioner is somebody who looks at everything the Buddha taught and takes them on personally as, this is my advice of how to practice. So again, this is a sort of a new lineage that formed in Tibet, but it was based on all the teachings that Atisha got from his gurus, that were from their gurus, that were again all the way back to Maitreya and Manjushri, and then back to Buddha Shakyamuni himself. Okay, so Lama Atisha had three, had one main disciple. His main disciple was Drontompa. Many of you know of Drontompa, Drontom Gyalwe Jungne. Again, he was the closest disciple of Lama Atisha's three main disciples. And he was a Kadampa master himself, and of course, was the main lineage holder of these. I think it said actually that Lama Atisha didn't disseminate these Lojong teachings to anyone other than Drontompa. And Drontompa, again, was actually a lay practitioner. He wasn't an ordained monk. And he had three main disciples that he disseminated these teachings to. I might mention before we go further on this that, again, these teachings weren't disseminated widely to people. This was something, again, that was believed to be important to be held somewhat secretive. And there are reasons for that, again, because these teachings can be very easily misunderstood. If you don't have a proper foundation, then you aren't a proper receptacle for them, because you don't have the understanding that allows you to use them well. This is kind of, again, the nature of a lot of these teachings, and there is that sort of tradition that carried over into a lot of Tibet, where they would have lineages that were whispered, that were only given to certain people because they only wanted them to be used by those who have that appropriate background. It's not any way of discriminating against anyone. It's the fact that this is how these teachings have to be given, or again, they can be, greatly misunderstood. We still have this, of course, with the tantric teachings in Tibet, because the tantric teachings can be greatly misunderstood. So I think this is important that we, kind of acknowledge that these teachings were kept secretive for a reason, because of the ability for us to misinterpret them and to possibly not use them correctly. So he disseminated these teachings to his three main disciples. These three disciples are, one, Geshe Chengawa, Chengawa Sultanbar, one of Drumtompa's three main disciples, which have come to be known as the Three Noble Brothers. And he's the patriarch of one portion of the teachings that they are called the Kadampa lineage of pith instructions. Again, I can't say much more about what each of these are, but they're all a part of what the Kadampa tradition has come to be known as. So he was the main patriarch of that. It's not to say that they weren't exposed to these other three things, but he became the patriarch of that branch of the Kadampa teachings. Geshe Pochungwa, Pochungwa Shonu Gyaltsen, he was one of Drontompa's disciples as well. He's the patriarch of the Kadampa lineage of oral transmissions. Again, became kind of the overseer of all of that, to make sure that that was sort of held, because these were all things that Drontompa received from Lama Atisha. The third was Geshe Potowa, and this is the most important of the three, perhaps, because this is where our lineage goes off into, is those students of Geshe, or student of Geshe Potowa, who became part of this lineage. Potowa Rinchen Sal, he's again patriarch of the Kadampa treatise lineage, kind of all of the treatises, the sources of these teachings, kind of the bearer of that, the lineage holder of that. Okay, so Geshe Potowa had Student who many of you have heard of, Geshe Langri Tangpa. Langri Tangpa Dorje Senge composed the 8 verses of thought transformation, which according to Thupten Jinpa is the first Lojong text that actually is called that. It's the first one that's actually called a mind training text. Most of you know the 8 verses because it's one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's favorite teachings, and no doubt you may have studied it as part of discovering Buddhism. It's the text that's normally taught in module 11 on transforming suffering into the path. But essentially, this is an amazing sort of condensation of the teachings. I will bring in verses here and there from that as we go through the 7-point mind training. But again, it's a very succinct set of verses. I might tell a little story about those verses myself. I was relatively new to Buddhism when I went to Tibet in 1994. I had the good fortune to be able to go there. A woman from the Bay Area was putting together a trip. I was living in San Francisco at the time, so I met with her, and this was her first trip into Tibet, so there were some obstacles, but nonetheless, we made it to Mount Kailash. That's there behind Dave in the screen. So essentially, yeah, it was 3 weeks in Tibet. It was one of the most wonderful experiences. But anyway, before I went there, I was working at Levi Strauss in San Francisco, and one of my coworkers had traveled in India, and she had this little piece of paper that she gave me. It was like photocopied 1,000 times maybe over. I don't know. It wasn't very good quality, but anyway, it was like a little photocopy of these 8 verses. And she said, before you go to Asia, I think you should take these with you because you might find them really useful as you travel around. And I think they were very useful because you always need to be able to practice kind of working with whatever comes up, right? And when you're in a foreign environment, an environment where who knows what's all going to happen and what sorts of things might arise, it's really important to have that, opportunity to make it into some sort of practice. So that was my first exposure to these 8 verses. And of course, then I read many other commentaries by the Dalai Lama, what have you, on the 8 verses. There are a number of those out there. And then I had the good fortune of receiving teachings from him in London in 1999, I think it was 98 or 99 on that text. But so again, a really wonderful text. I encourage you to spend some time with that text as well. But Geshe Langri Tangpa wrote this text, and this was something that Geshe Chikawa, who is the author of the text that we're looking at, came across. He came across in particular, of course, he saw all of the verses, but the one that really got him, the one that like really made him like go, oh my gosh, I've never heard such things before, was verse number 5. Let me put that on the screen. I could recite it to you as well, but I'll read it from the screen. When out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, insults, or the like, I shall accept defeat and offer the victory to others. So he heard this and he was like, whoa, this is like really serious stuff. This is like Dharma that I've never heard of before. You know, what are you talking about? I'm supposed to give the victory to others. I'm supposed to take the defeat. You know, this sounds like really revolutionary. Of course, that's the big thing. Lojong is revolutionary. That's why it was kept secret. So he went in search of Langri Tangpa, because Geshe Chikawa wanted to find the author of this text. He wanted to find, you know, where do these teachings come from? I've never heard these teachings before. And of course, by that time, Geshe Langri Tangpa had already passed away. However, he found one of Geshe Langri Tangpa's disciples. I think it was a disciple of Geshe Langri Tangpa. Yep. He was a disciple, actually, of Potowa, I'm sorry, and guru of Geshe Chikawa. I couldn't find a picture on the internet of Geshe Sharawa. I found that really strange because he's really very renowned. So he was kind of a co-disciple with Langri Tangpa of Potowa, Geshe Potowa. And so essentially Geshe Sharawa was still there, and somehow Geshe Chikawa got directed to him by various people who knew, you know, that Geshe Sharawa had studied with Geshe Langri Tangpa. And he said, maybe you can go to him and find out what's going on with this. Okay, so Geshe Chikawa, of course, he wasn't known as Geshe Chikawa then, just Chikawa, went to see Geshe Sharawa, and he asked him about that teaching in particular. He said, is it true that we have to practice this way, that we have to give the victory to others and accept defeat ourselves? Is this, you know, really part of our path to enlightenment? And Geshe Sharawa said, not only is this part of our path to enlightenment, it's essential that we practice this way. There's no way we can attain enlightenment without practicing this way. So this assured Geshe Chikawa that he was onto something here with Geshe Shiro, and he asked if he could study with him. I think he studied with him for something like 12, 13 years. He became sort of lineage holder, again, of all of these amazing teachings that were still very secretive. You know, Geshe Potawa giving them to his disciples, and Geshe Sharwawa choosing particular disciples that he would give them to. And again, based on Geshe Chikawa's integrity and his teachings and what have you, he decided that he would disseminate them to him. So this is Geshe Chikawa. Again, I think that's the same picture I put on the little booklet that I supplied you for this course. Chikawa Yeshe Dorje, he lived in the 12th century. He's, again, the composer of the text that we have, the 7-point mind training. You might wonder, well, where did this text come from then, if this is such a secretive teaching? Well, there's a couple of stories about Geshe Chikawa as he began to practice these teachings. His power, of course, in his bodhicitta became even stronger, and he had these amazing abilities. I'm going to share a little bit from, this was my original entryway into Tibetan Buddhism, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche, still a very treasured book on my shelf, that on page 193 of this version, at least, I know it's been republished, probably with a lot of different pagination, but he says, you know, one of the greatest masters of Tonglen in Tibet was Geshe Chikawa, who lived in the, he says 11th century, but it was the 12th century. He was extremely learned and accomplished in many different forms of meditation. One day, when he happened to be in his teacher's room, he came across that, you know, give all profit and gain to others, take all loss and defeat on yourself. So he, you know, set out to find a master who had written to him. Again, he went to Geshe Sharwawa and studied with him. And it says here, at first, Geshe Chikawa taught Tonglen to only a few close disciples. Again, Tonglen is one of the main teachings that's part of the Lojong teaching. So Geshe Chikawa became very established in these teachings, practiced them greatly, and he started to disseminate them to his closest disciples. So he thought it would only work for those who had great faith in it. Then he began to teach it to a group of lepers. Leprosy at that time was common in Tibet, and ordinary doctors were unable to treat or cure it. But many of the lepers who did Tonglen practice were cured. Just by doing the practice, it said that they were cured of their illness, their leprosy. The news of this spread fast, and other lepers flocked to his house, which began to seem like a hospital. Still, Geshe Chikawa didn't teach Tonglen widely. He may have taught it to those lepers and taught it to his other students, but he didn't really feel like there was a need for it to go beyond that. It was only when he noticed the effect it had on his brother that he began to give it out more publicly. Geshe Chikawa's brother was an inveterate skeptic who derided all forms of spiritual practice. However, when he saw what was happening to the lepers who were practicing Tonglen, this brother could not help being impressed and intrigued. One day he hid behind a door and listened to Geshe Chikawa teaching Tonglen, and then, in secret, started doing the practice on his own. When Geshe Chikawa noticed that his brother's hard character was beginning to soften, he guessed what had happened. If this practice could work on my brother, he thought, and transform him, then it could work on and transform any other human being. In other words, like, that was the test. If it could, you know, get through his brother, then everyone else is a suitable subject for these teachings. So this convinced him to teach these teachings, Tonglen. Of course, he emphasizes Tonglen in that book, but it's, you know, Tonglen is one part of the 7-point mind training, but it's in a very important part, a very powerful practice, as many of you already know. We'll be getting into that next week. But essentially, this was how Geshe Chikawa came to write this text. Now, again, this text in and of itself is very much rooted in the teachings that Atisha left behind. If you have that copy of the mind training text, mind training collection that Thupten Jinpa put together, he translated, you'll see that there's Lama Atisha's pieces of advice that pertain to many of the points that have been put together by Geshe Chikawa. He's not writing anything, again, completely original. He's taking Lama Atisha's thoughts that were articulated to Drum Thompa, and then on to Geshe Potowa, and then on to Sharawa, and then, of course, to Geshe Chikawa. So he's taking all of those points and putting them into a summary form. Now, one thing I might mention before we, again, Geshe Chikawa himself, of course, this text became very widely distributed within Tibet, became very popular, was something that, again, all of the Mahayana traditions in Tibet, all four of the Tibetan Buddhist schools, all practice this, all have teachers who comment on it and so on. So it's now, of course, Tonglen and all this. I was even reading a book by Rob Preece where he said that Tonglen is even practiced, to his knowledge, by many people who are Christian, you know, who find that it really enhances their spiritual path to think in this way, to practice Tonglen. So again, we'll talk about Tonglen more next week. But essentially, this whole lineage gives us a deeper appreciation for the value of these teachings. If it wasn't for, again, Lama Atisha's great efforts to bring these lineages together, to be able to disseminate these teachings, because again, it's from Sir Lingpa, where he made that in very arduous journey to Indonesia to be able to obtain these teachings. It's due to that that we have them. If that hadn't happened, who knows where these teachings would be. So again, although these go all the way back to the sutras of the Buddha, it's got a whole little story about how we ended up with these teachings in front of us. So I did want to talk a little bit as well today about this particular version of the text that we have, the 7 points as presented by Pabongka Rinpoche. Let me not go to that quite yet. Let me actually get out my little copy of it that I think I have here somewhere. So again, if you were able to, I don't know, I put this together in a little booklet kind of thing that you could do a little booklet cover, and then there's the actual text that you can print double-sided and it'll work out really nicely to make a booklet. If that's really problematic for anybody and you can't, you know, make that work, then let me know and I can get it to you in another form. But essentially this, again, I mentioned earlier, this is a version. There are so many different versions of the 7-point mind training. I think some of them even have something like 70 slogans in them. I don't know where all these additional slogans came from, but there were so many different versions that at one point, Pabongka Rinpoche, who lived in the beginning of the 20th century, when he's renowned for having kind of come into giving many great teachings in the early 1920s, liberation in the palm of your hand is from a gathering of monks that took place around then. But essentially, he decided that it was important that we have one definitive tradition, text for our tradition. Again, he's part of the Gelugpa tradition, the tradition that is derived from Lama Tsongkhapa and the lineage of the Dalai Lamas. Pabongka Rinpoche kind of went and did a lot of research and came up with this particular version that is used frequently when it's taught in the Gelugpa school. So this particular version, let me read a little bit. I can put that on the screen. I'm sorry it's so small, but I thought I'd just put it all on one screen. This is also in the booklet that you have on page 1. In the literature of the old and new Kadampa, what is the old and new Kadampa? We talked about Kadampa being, again, these this lineage of taking all the words as practical instructions. The old one is the one that started with Lama Atisha. The new one is the one that started with Lama Tsongkhapa, who again was seen to be an extension of Lama Atisha in terms of what he was focusing on, the Lam Rim and so on, and so much of what Lama Atisha was about. So often the new Kadampa lineage is talked about as being Lama Tsongkhapa's lineage of disciples, Kedrupje, Gyaltsepje, all of the various things that they were able to accomplish that we still continue to benefit from today. So, in the literature of both of those, there are many versions of the commentaries and root text of the 7-point mind training. The order of presentation and the number of words in them differs greatly. Some of them we cannot confidently incorporate within the outlines when we are giving an explanation, and some include unfamiliar verses in the root text. For these reasons, I, Pabongka Rinpoche, had been thinking for a long time of producing a definitive root text by collating the additions to be found in the mind training, like the rays of the sun, ornament for Losong's thought, and the essential nectar. These three texts was what he kind of went to as sources for this. Mind training like the rays of the sun is where I'm actually, the translation by Bruce Beresford that I got this from. This is in the appendix of that. So he says here, when Pabongka Rinpoche says then, when I was teaching the stages of the path to enlightenment at Chamdo Jampa Ling in 1935 in the wood pig year, if you want to know that. Lamrimpa Punsok Palden, a single-minded practitioner, presented me a scarf, the kata, the ceremonial katas, and an offering, and made such a request, you know, please, you know, compile a definitive edition of the 7-point mind training. So, Babanka Rinpoche says, I have compiled this after careful research of many root texts and commentaries and supplemented it with outlines. So, this is what we are essentially looking at in terms of the text that we have in front of us. I just want to talk about that because I think it is important that we acknowledge that, again, there's some history to even what we have in front of us in terms of this version, because if you do go to other versions, like Chogyam Trungpa's that I mentioned, or even what's another one? I don't have all those other books here in front of me, but there are several other published books of commentaries, some from the Nyingma tradition, some from the Kagyu tradition. I haven't read any from the Sakya tradition, but essentially you might find different verses, you might find different even outline headings, what have you. But this is the way that Babanka Rinpoche put this together. So if we go into the actual thing, just to do a real brief overview of this, we go to page 2. We're going to start today with, of course, this little homage, and then talk a little bit about these, this little verse that's put in here, revealing the features of the doctrine to engender respect for the instruction. The actual 7 points begin then in the middle of page 2. And the first one we'll cover today, I hope we can finish that today, is explaining the preliminaries as a basis for the practice. And even though it's just one slogan, there's quite a bit to talk about in regard to that. Next week, we'll begin on Tuesday, the actual practice, training in the awakening mind, bodhicitta. That is being divided into 2 parts. Now, I'm going to teach it in the way that mind training like the rays of the sun teaches it, which is essentially to go through A or B first, which is how to train a conventional awakening mind, and then continue through the rest of the text, and then do 2A at the very end. And it makes a lot of sense to do that because, again, everything, we're going to lump everything together that's part of our compassion wing, our method wing, and then at the very end, we're going to look at the wisdom wing, which again are these slogans that are in 2A. So that's why I've put them together in kind of the opposite direction. It says, and we'll go through this when we go through it, I put A being training in the conventional awakening mind and B training in the ultimate, and we'll do that at the tail end. The third outline is again one of the most, we'll spend a lot of time on that, at least one full session, because this is where we get into the heart of the Lojong teachings, which is how do we use these adverse conditions that we have in our daily experience as part of our path. You know, not let ourselves, as His Holiness said, you know, become hindered by that, have that be an obstacle for us. When things are going bad, it's actually the ideal time to practice, you know, as has been going on in this world forever, really. I mean, but, you know, obviously we have a lot of challenging conditions going on in our world right now that we need to be able to use as doorways for awakening. The fourth is the integrated practice of a single lifetime, just some brief instructions on how do we make this like a lifetime practice and be sure that even we practice it at the time of death so that we use every part of our life, you know, to greatest benefit. The fifth one is the measure of having trained the mind. I mean, how do we know when we've actually accomplished something in regard to our, you know, mind training practice? So this is on page 4. And so there are some nice little slogans there about kind of what are the things that keep us in line with making sure that we are integrating it into our lives and have that Lojong become something we're very familiar with. Now, number 6 and 7, they sound very familiar. Commitments of mind training and precepts of mind training. The commitments are kind of what we should be, kind of the boundaries and what we should do and shouldn't do in regard to how we want to progress and make our mind training, you know, grow even more. The precepts are sort of the things that we have to guard in order to make sure that it doesn't degenerate. And so again, these are very close to each other, but you'll see the bulk of the slogans are there, right? We've got 18 under number 6 and 22 under number 7. That's 40 out of these slogans. So again, as you can see, there are quite a few other slogans. I don't know, maybe there's even more than 50 in this, 60 some. I don't know. I never counted them. Maybe I'll have to count them before the next class so I know how many are there. But, and then there's a nice little kind of conclusion concluding verse from Geshe Chikawa. Again, I've got the source there. Hopefully that is still a valid source for this teaching, this version of this that I took from Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives. If you turn to page 6, I just want to mention before we go too much further that I did put together sort of a selected commentaries on 7-point mind training. The one that I mentioned earlier, that is this version is used in, which I would encourage you, most of you may have this free book. Again, this was a Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive free book called The Kindness of Others, commentary on the 7-point mind training by Geshe Jampa Tekchuk. I usually refer to him as Kensur Jampa Tekchuk because he's a former abbot. But anyway, he passed away some years ago, but nonetheless, this is a really short little commentary and it might be worthwhile to have this. And I'll even make some page references to this as to what you might read in preparation for each class, if you'd like to do that. But this is, again, a very easy, I kept there available for free at Thupten Norbu Ling, and that's because this original version I did was for when I taught here in Santa Fe at our center. But you can probably get a copy from Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archives, but you can also just download it. It's a download from lamayeshe.com. Then in terms of the second book, this is a wonderful book that I mentioned earlier, that is part of that three-book series of His Holiness's teachings, that one on the Lojong text, 7-point mind training. There's also Geshe Rabten and Geshe Darge and so on, the essential mind training. And that, of course, is the shorter version of the larger mind training text if you didn't want to buy that huge book, mind training like the rays of the sun and so on. And there's a few others that are, again, the last few are from other traditions. Start Where You Are is Pema Chodron's wonderful commentary, Digo Kensei Rinpoche, who was a great Nyingma master, his commentary on that, and Jamgon Kontrol, who I think was Nyingma, but also a bit more of the Rimei tradition, the non-sectarian tradition. So there are lots of commentaries you could go to, and you'll get different takes on things sometimes. I might mention that what we generally are encouraged to do in terms of our study, which I was encouraged to when I studied in the master's program in Italy, is to stay within your own tradition initially. So like, you know, what I'm presenting to you is sort of the Gelugpa take on it, mostly from Gelugpa masters, their commentaries, and then you can, you know, kind of learn that well. You know, then maybe you can start looking at other commentaries from other traditions, from a Kagyu or a Nyingma point of view, what have you. And that's just because it's good to know your own tradition first before you start mixing it with others, because then you end up with kind of a pot of who knows what, all these various things, and you don't know what is definitive, which is the teachings that you might, you know, rely upon more closely, because you've got too many things in the pot. So that's the idea behind, again, the text that might be of some use to you as we go through this.